You know, we can't live like this forever, so our schools better be ready. And also, let's be nice to the people that teach your children and turn off 24-hour news. Lunches aren't free. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
No free lunch. Betsy. Y'all know Betsy DeVos, remember? She's that woman occupying an office with the title Secretary of Education, a title that was obviously purchased considering she has zero qualifications to lead a federal department charged with advocating and upholding public education policy in the United States. But at this point, being qualified is just so last year, and it is clear that Ms. DeVos was never really appointed to care for public education, as evidenced by her hiring of a white, kinda, sorta right-leaning supremacist-type person to head up the Office of Civil Rights, and her attempts to allow predatory student loan companies to direct college lending policy. However, I need to go back to her no free lunch statement. And let me start with this. She's right. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Trust me, I know. You see, back in the late 70s, I was a lower middle class kid from a rusty steel town in Pennsylvania. My dad worked for U.S. Steel and made sure that our families always had not just lunch, but breakfast and dinner too. We even crammed into a Dodge Dart every summer to drive to Ocean City, Maryland, stay a week in a hotel with two beds, one for my parents, one for my brother and me. Even on those family vacations, my dad made sure that we ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Granted, it was usually bologna sandwiches, hot dogs, and cereal, but we didn't starve. Hell, we even went out to eat at a restaurant once during the week. Life was awesome. Seriously, I had no idea I was, quote, lower middle class. And then, 1980, the collapse of U.S. Steel and the collapse of the economy of my little world and the collapse of my willful ignorance of what it meant to be one paycheck away from being poor. Even then, I'm not sure I grasped the situation fully. It was only one night at dinner when my father announced that he had been laid off. Huh? What does that mean? I found out my dad lost his job and that saying laid off was supposed to give you hope that he might be hired back. That never happened. I'll never forget that moment. I was in seventh grade, I was in a public school, and I was ignorant to the economic conditions outside of my world, except for an occasional glimpse. You see, on Monday morning, some of my friends, and quite a few other kids I didn't know, would not go directly to our classrooms. Instead, they went to sign up for their free and reduced lunches for the week. Yeah, I had friends that got a free lunch. I didn't really think about it that hard. Hell, I even probably joked about the free lunch people when they weren't around. What an idiot I was. Because the following year in eighth grade, I found myself on Monday mornings going to the free and reduced lunch sign-up, and that's when it hit me. I was poor. Or at least according to the government, my father's income had dropped enough so that my brother and I could get a free lunch. And that's when I found out there is no such thing as a free lunch. All you get is a huge heaping of shame, followed by a serving of self-loathing, smothered with self-pity, and a desire to never stand in that fucking free lunch line again. You're absolutely right, Betsy, trust me, and all the other kids that needed and still do need them. There is no such thing as a fucking free lunch.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Well, you know what I think about free lunches, but hey, I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would say about the existence of free lunches.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Matt Damon's mom, Nancy, yes. My friend.
Yes.
Betsy DeVos, our new Secretary of Education, is quoted as saying there is no such thing as a free lunch. What the hell did she mean?
No, I think she was making some kind of off-the-cuff comment about something Bernie Sanders had done. But what it made me think about, of course, now she's head of the lunch program, right?
Right, right.
But what it made me think about is and feel about is that we have 31 million kids in the U.S. who qualify for free lunch. And that makes me think about the sad fact that that the majority of kids in our public schools now are low income, 51%. So let's just acknowledge that we have just extreme income inequality in our country. So the fact that we're even talking about a free lunch, what is a free lunch? Really? And just not as a joke, but it's because kids are hungry and because their families can't afford enough food to feed them adequately that they get a free lunch at school. And that's a pretty sad situation in a country this wealthy that we have that many kids who are poor.
Right. But how far off is it, though, when you think about what you just said? You know, okay, well, maybe she didn't actually mean anything about the free lunch program or the free and reduced lunch program we have in this country for hungry children. However, I'm not sure about that because was it a week or two later, the budget director for the Trump administration actually came out and said, you know, I'm paraphrasing his quote, but, you know, look, we have no tangible evidence that feeding children helps their achievement.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, they're trying. The Republicans are trying to cut back the free lunch program.
Yeah, and you're sitting there going, okay. First of all, I don't really give a poop if it has anything to do with achievement. How about the fact, as one person said, it makes a hungry kid unhungry. Or,
right.
You know, and so
yeah.
If you're not hungry, and that's a good thing. So if we're giving free lunches to hungry people and it stops them from being hungry, maybe that in and of itself is an okay result.
At the very surface of it, just feeding kids in school is a great idea. Kids need to eat pretty often, which most parents know. And, you know, having a good, delicious, healthy meal in the middle of the day for kids is a great thing for schools to do, regardless of their income level. Just a healthy thing to be eating well and have a couple snacks, too, during the day. I mean, they're there for a long time, and some they need to eat. But also, some of them, it's the only meal they get.
I used to keep Tic Tacs in the drawer and give them Tic Tacs for breakfast. No.
But many times,
when I was a second grade teacher, in rural Virginia, I had in my drawer, and it was actually the school nurse who came to me and gave me snacks. And she said, and she specifically told me, here are the students that you might want to offer these to at around a certain time, you know, because they knew the students, they had worked with them.
Yeah.
And the idea was that, you know, they're hungry. They're truly hungry. And so, I look back at that and think, man, talk about 22-year-old teaching second grade in Virginia, and here I am and somebody hitting me in the face truly with poverty and saying, look, you're going to need to feed these kids. And now here we are, you know, 30 years later, and we've got a multi-billionaire in charge of our public schools making off-the-hand comments about no free lunches.
You know, one of the things that's really hard for me about that is the hard-heartedness of the comments like that. And of any policymakers who make comments like it doesn't make any difference to kids' achievement, or some of the kids who get these free meals don't really deserve them or need them. You know, they're hard-hearted comments that just don't reflect any kind of compassionate society. And any kind of compassionate attention towards children. It's really very discouraging to think that policymakers can say things like that and do things like that, you know, without some serious twinges on the conscience.
Well, that's why we have you, Matt Damon's mom, on the show, because there's always a free lunch with Matt's mom.
I'm going to start charging you for these calls.
I think so.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
He is the author of The Geography of Nowhere, The City in Mind, Notes on the Urban Condition, Home from Nowhere, and The Long Emergency, and a host of other books.
books, both fiction and nonfiction. He's also the author of the no-holds-barred blog Clusterfuck Nation, located at Kunstler.com. Welcome to Busted Pencils, James Howard Kunstler.
Well, it's nice to be with you, Tim. It's a pleasure. So far,
it's been a pleasure, right? Didn't get very far. But we're going to go with Jim, though, right? Not James.
Yeah, sure.
You've written extensively about what you see as a coming unavoidable crisis, and I think you'd say it's linked exclusively to what you and some others have referred to as peak oil, and then you explore this in your book, The Long Emergency.
Well, I wouldn't say it's linked exclusively to peak oil, but the dynamic relationship between oil and our economy and money and finance are pretty crucial to the story.
How does this work? What is peak oil? What do you mean by that? I mean, I think there are a ton of people out there that have no clue what that means.
Well, it's not as simple as it seems. You know, a few years ago, people thought it just meant, you know, you reach a point where you run out of oil and then it costs too much. But that's not how it's worked out at all. It's really much more a matter of running out of affordable oil that we can afford to pump out of the ground. The affordability has gone way down from, you know, the height of the oil industry in the 1950s, when you got 100 barrels out of the ground for every barrel you got put in, to about 17 barrels of energy for every barrel you put in. And the trouble with that is that at that ratio, you can't really run industrial civilizations of the kind we have. So you have to start shedding activities. You know, whether it's suburban commuting or trucking or big box shopping or large corporations or theme park vacations. But, you know, insidiously what's happened actually is we haven't shed any one of those activities in particular. What we've done is destroyed the middle class. So that's how it's playing out. I think most Americans who actually read the news and try to stay alert to what's going on in the country really don't get the oil story, and it's unfortunate. I'm not sure that they ever will. I think it will kind of climax in a financial calamity that will compel us to live differently, very differently, whether we like it or not. And unfortunately, you know, we're not going to be emotionally prepared for it.
Okay, so I've seen all those things. In fact, from your blog post from February 20th, you talk about, you know, quote, a living arrangement with no future, a matrix of extreme car dependency that has zero chance of continuing with another decade of more Walmarts, Targets, Taco Bells, muffler shops, McHousing subdivisions, all of these things. So we're not prepared, though. I think that's the scary thing when I look at what you're talking about is that when this hit happens, if you're saying, you know, at some point the financial glass houses, house of cards that we've created, and when this comes crashing, how are we going to reassign civilization, or is that too extreme?
No, we're going to have what I would call a reset of the terms of civilization. And let's just remember that societies are emergent phenomena. That is, they are essentially self-organizing organisms, let's say. You know, they respond, societies respond to the circumstances of their time and place, and reality has a way of instructing you what to do. And in our culture, you know, we're gonna go through a period of discontinuity, which, you know, you can translate as political economic disorder. And then, you know, our reality will instruct us how to do it. You know, the big question is, how damaging will all that disorder be? You know, how much will we lose, and how difficult will it be for us to land on our feet? And where are we going to land exactly? You know, are we going to land in the 1850s, or, you know, or are we going medieval? We don't really know yet.
Okay. Well, I'll either save my chainmail or my flintlock, and depend on which one it is that I'm going to need. We'll look.
Good
at
choice.
This is the question for this being, again, going back to an education show. A lot of teachers are listening, and I'm sure a lot of teachers have read some of your books and even have a sense of the long emergency. Do you have any hope in teachers in public education? Should teachers themselves be imagining that part of this is their responsibility to teach, quote, you know, the long emergency and how to live sustainably?
Well, I don't really have a lot of expectation that that's going to happen at this stage. You know, I think we've kind of made our bed and we're going to have to lie in it. Perhaps a more appropriate question would be, what form might education take in the future? And it's not going to be what we're doing now, that's for sure. But there's no question that education is going to remain important. I mean, the knowledge that the human race has accumulated is tremendously important. I am fairly confident that we're going to lose quite a bit of it, especially the more refined and complex parts. But, you know, we're going to be able to retain quite a bit, too, and that's going to be the work of the future.
Well, I wondered about that whole idea because, I mean, in any type of, catastrophe like that, the knowledge that's lost, and whether it's protected, whether it's through libraries, and we see, you know, just any type of decimation in any type of country we go for, and we eliminate libraries and things like that, the attack on knowledge. And again, I come back to teachers being wondering if they're not an ally for Jim Kunstler.
Well, so far they haven't been, and I don't expect them to turn into that. You know, I expect them to go with the flow like everybody else. More to the point, what is our model for education now, and how unreal is it, and where's it going in the future? And I would say, you know, our model basically is the large industrialized centralized school district, mm-hmm. where, you know, you build a giant school, you bring students in from a giant pupil shed of X number of miles around by a yellow school bus fleet. And, you know, that's how we do it. We're not going to be able to do that anymore. You know, we're going to lose the ability to run those kinds of institutions. And let's be clear that it was kind of a tragic blunder to do that in the first place. You know, we did it for reasons that seemed to be good at the time. And that's my new theory of history, by the way. Things happen because they seem like a good idea at the time. but those centralized school districts are not going to survive. I think kids will be lucky in the future to get the equivalent of an eighth grade education, a good eighth grade education, and that a lot of people will not be educated. I think that most of the colleges are going to contract or disappear. Okay. We're not going to be able to support those either in the coming austerity. And, college or the equivalent of higher ed, whatever that ends up being, is going to be a very special thing and probably a thing for, you know, small groups of people. So, the whole idea that the democratization of education was a permanent feature of the human condition, you know, we're going to discover that was really a temporary state of affairs. And, you know, it's one of the things that just amazes me is how people assume that whatever's been going on lately in your lifetime is going to continue forever. And that's sort of where we're at.
Right. Well, we definitely don't have a long view. We can say that. And I look at that as someone who teaches history originally, but now for some reason they call me Dean. I have no idea why, what I've done. But, you know, hey, sometimes some people are fooled by what you present to them. But, I'm thinking about this and I'm imagining, and it sounds tribal. What you're talking about in the sustainability of the future. And so when you talk about, for example, I know right in Wisconsin where we record this show, in the Northwoods in Wisconsin, where they are busing, as you said, students, you know, an hour and 20 minutes one way to get to school. And you're saying, look, that's not sustainable. The other thing then is so what are we going to put in its place? Schools that educate 2 and 3 children?
Well, I mean, that's going to an extreme, although, you know, who knows? I think you can state categorically that one of the features of our response up ahead of this long emergency that I write about is going to be that things are just going to have to become a whole lot more local and a whole lot smaller. Now, that doesn't mean going from, you know, the transnational corporation down to the Aboriginal tribe. There's a lot of room in between. But, you know, I think that's basically the idea. Get ready to get more local. Get ready to get smaller. Get ready to be more to be less complex in your arrangements. You know, and that would suggest to me smaller schools, for sure, probably distributed more equitably around where people live. But, you know, you knowing that I have written these books about the fiasco of suburbia, mm-hmm. you know, that should tell you that, you know, we already have a problem with the even more general living arrangement in America. It's because we don't really live in towns anymore. You know, the current living arrangement doesn't lend itself to even, you know, making the school smaller. So we're going to have to deal with that whole issue at the whole time that we're at the same time that we're, you know, trying to figure out how we're going to, you know, pass on knowledge and continue the process of education.
It's interesting to listen to you talk about this because tonight at the local school district where my house happens to be in a suburbia, which used to be a small town that has now started turning into a sprawling suburbia, the big idea that they're going to be presenting is the need for this referendum to increase our school by so many thousands of feet. And if you were there, you would tell them what?
I would tell them beware of making really bad misinvestments in the future. You know, of throwing your money away on things that are demonstrably not sustainable. And but like I said, you know, the tendency is for people to think that whatever they're doing now will continue indefinitely. So, you know, it's hard to make that argument because the conventional thinking is such an enormous obstacle.
Well, back to the whatever you want to say cliche, grow, baby, grow. I mean, this is good. Growth is good, and continued growth is continued goodness. And so
let me just interject something here. You know, it's important, I think, for listeners to know this.
Okay.
Something that was once at the core of a liberal education is the idea that life is tragic. And by that, I don't mean that everything turns out badly. What I mean is that there are consequences to the choices that you make. And there are consequences to the choices that we make collectively as a society. And if we make bad choices, you know, we're going to have to feast at the banquet of consequences, as Robert Louis Stevenson put it. And we've made a lot of bad choices, and it's tragic. But history is not going to shed a tear for our blunders.
Well, we're going to write about it, so maybe in the new historians in the new schools. James Howard Kunstler, Jim, it's a very disturbing future you predict, and I want to thank you, though, for quote, educating the listeners here at Busted Pencils, and remind everyone to make sure that if you want to follow Jim, to go to Kunstler, that's KUNSTLER.com/cluster.
You don't even have to go to the slash. Just Kunstler.com will take you to
Kunstler.com.
My blog.
Are you keeping me from saying that word?
No, don't even bother.
Okay, don't bother. Jim, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, Tim, great to talk to you.
The guest that is so nice, we get to hear from him twice. Stick around, because later in the show, James Howard Kunstler lets us know what kind of schools our children deserve.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Welcome to Busted Pencils, our activist of the week. He is the author of the best-selling sci-fi series, The Watchers of the novella series, Solitary, which are both available in paperback and for e-readers. You can follow him on Twitter at Monty Fowler. You can go to his website, LAMONTEMFOWLER.com. He is Lamont M. Fowler, and I think we can just call him Monty, right, Monty?
That sounds good to me.
Monty, welcome to Busted Pencils.
Oh, thanks very much, Tim. Nice to be here.
Regardless of your main sense of writing in sci-fi, you put a piece, you laid some truth on Huffington Post a few weeks back. It's called Read This Before You Say Anything Else About Taking Back America. I read it, and the first thing I thought of was, this piece is so awesome. Literally, we'll say it here, kicks ass, busts pencils. I got concerned, though, because when I read through it, I went, the problem is that I have to be educated to understand the bomb you were dropping on us.
Well, you know, I try to write for the common man, but unfortunately, I think in the last 20 years, maybe 30 years, the level of the common man has dipped a little bit, and that really concerns me. And as someone who's married to a professional educator and a distinguished teacher, you know, I hear from the front lines every night some of the horror stories and challenges around raising the next generation of thoughtful, intellectually curious people, and that really concerns me.
Well, I'm really concerned too, and seriously, when I read pieces like this, as much as I love It's in Your Face, I really get concerned about thinking how many people, you know, at what point are we moving in a direction? Our education system, you know, we've got 30 plus years of accountability, teaching kids to take tests, teaching kids things that actually don't matter. We've got a war on now, you know, absolutely in front of us, a war on quote, you know, truth or whatever you want to call it, alt truth. Hell, I don't even know where we are, if we're at future truth, alternative truth, post-truth, whatever it is. But this whole idea, and, you know, let's come back to it. You say facts, but I want to read a little bit of a piece of this just so people get a sense. So this is, read this before you say anything else about taking back America, from Monty Fowler. I need to drop a little truth on y'all, so buckle up. I'm about to be politically incorrect. Fox News, CNN, MSNBC have an agenda and are not, quote, fair and balanced or in any way unbiased. I'll reiterate, read more. Read newspapers, even online ones. Read lots of opinions and sources. And then, stay with me here, think. Form your own opinion based on as many facts as your brain can tolerate. Speaking of facts, there actually is a difference between facts, opinions, and propaganda. Science is real. We know things because of science. Don't be afraid of it. You have an iPhone and a Facebook because of science. Global warming or climate change, as the cool kids call it, is real. Anyone who tells you it's not real is not smart and is probably not capable of dressing themselves. Racism exists, and you are probably a little racist, and you should work on that seriously. Monty.
Yeah.
Man, that's just part of it, dude.
Yeah. I was surprised at the react. Well, actually, I wasn't surprised at some of the reactions I got. I guess I was surprised at how many people resonated with some of the things or all of the things that I was saying in here. So far, about 2.5 million people have read this. I've gotten about 250,000 comments, vast majority positive, some of them exceedingly negative, some of them just plain hysterical for how, you know, much they just mangled the English language. And I absolutely cannot resist poking back a little bit. But the thing that really surprised me was, you know, and if you read the whole thing, you realize that there was a certain amount of snark slash sarcasm and satire that was injected into the piece. That's just my tone. That's my natural way of being. I was horrified at how many people didn't get that. Some people were calling me arrogant and lots of other horrible names, and the fact that some of it was satirical and some of it was just a little snarky seemed to be completely lost on a certain segment of the population. And I guess after November 8th, I was just like, oh, okay, I get it now.
You know what, though?
I don't
think it's lost. I mean, I think that's intentional because, I mean, you hit, you know, you really did. You blew up a big bomb here. You hit a truth chord. And for some, I think of the people that are hitting you with negative and going, oh, you're just snarky. Oh, this is just satire. Oh, this is just you being arrogant. You hit them smack in the face with a truth bomb that they just can't handle.
Yeah. Well, and I think, look, some of the things I said in here were I really deeply mean because I'm guilty of them myself. I mean, racism exists. It does, because you know what? Every single person is a little bit biased, prejudiced, and or racist, you know, and that comes from our upbringing. I don't care where you're raised. You know, we view others as other, and we tend to fear the things that we don't understand. So, you know, I remember walking down the street as a kid with my grandmother, and, you know, if there was a person of color coming up the same side of the street or even across the street, even as a kid, I noticed how she would move her purse to the other side of her body away from the person that was coming and clutch it a little bit tighter. And those types of signals, person doesn't have to say anything like, right. Oh, I think, you know, a certain person is bad. You can tell by their body language, by the way they react. And We all have that, and that's something that as a country we need to really, really work on. The first place you can work on it is just by recognizing it. Hey, you know what? I sometimes think that way too. That's not okay.
Yeah, and I tell you what, that's a hard one. One of our regular activists who's been on the show a few times, Paul Thomas, who mostly is an education writer, has really been hitting the racism thing really hard. And here's a Southern white man who's saying exactly what you just said and saying we need to admit this. And so, and again, I encourage everybody to please go to Huffington Post if you haven't already. Even though there's 2.2 million readers, there are still 200 million plus readers that still need to get this. It's at the Huffington Post. It's Monty Fowler. It's read this before you say anything else about taking back America. Because for me, this is an education in what you did in this piece. And that was why I wanted to feature you as our activist of the week specifically, because what you did in this, page and a half that people print out, your stream of consciousness, your thought, though, is really lay out why education matters and these issues are so important. I want to get to one of your other pieces, and I want to quote it, though, too. And I love, because this is it's a teacher's show for the most part, sure. But be nice. This is from Monty. Be nice to the people who teach your children. Don't send them nasty emails or yell at them. Their job is 10,000 times harder than your stupid job. You're not a professional educator, so just shut your mouth and be thankful someone is willing to teach your offspring. Now, teachers are loving that, but you know what? I put that on my Facebook page. It was amazing the amount of people who were like, oh my God, spot on. Thank you, Tim. Thanks for putting Monty's stuff up. This is great. However, boy, they were few, but I got a ton of people going, how arrogant are you? What do you mean my job's stupid and all this stuff? But this sense, are you protecting educators here because your wife's an educator, or do you mean this piece?
Well, I mean it for a couple of reasons. One, I'm married to an educator, and she was a mid-career. She switched over to be an educator, and, she didn't have to. She had a great career beforehand and made a lot of money and raised our kids, and she sacrifices every day to do that job, and that job is super important. I mean, I can't imagine, other than maybe being the doctor that saves your life in the ER, I can't imagine another job where you shoulder so much responsibility, because you're literally shaping the mind, the personality, and the citizenship of another human being every single day. And you're doing it to 25 or 30 kids every year, year after year. That's huge. And it's hard. And it requires an extremely dedicated person, someone who is very, very serious about their craft, someone who's willing to sacrifice hundreds, if not thousands, of additional hours that you never get paid for. So I'm sorry. I know what I do for a living and the amount of money that I get paid. And frankly, it's obscene when you compare what I do and what I get paid to do with what my wife and all of her colleagues do.
Now, what you do is obscene to get paid that much, or no?
No. The fact that I get paid four times as much as my wife. And every other teacher that I know.
Well, you must be doing well, because we know teachers are well overpaid.
Oh yeah, I know. But it's a ridiculous equation in our culture when you consider that you're shaping human beings. I'm just selling crap that people probably don't even need. That's backward to me. So I get very frustrated when I hear people complain about teachers, and I get just straight up mad when I hear stories of parents coming in and shaking their finger in teachers' faces and literally trying to tell them how to do their job. They are professionals, just like your doctor, your lawyer. You would never dream of walking into a lawyer's office or your accountant's office and yelling at them, telling them they don't know how to do their job. You would never do that, because you know that they've got a specialized education, they've passed a specialized licensing, and they know more than you do. why don't we afford that same courtesy and respect to teachers? I just don't understand it.
It's a wonderful question, and I want to remind people what you just said, though. So be nice to the people who teach your children.
Yeah.
I think we need to read this. You end with a piece that I think everybody needs to hear. We are the United States of America, and we can afford to, quote, house every homeless veteran, feed every child, and take in every refugee, and still have money left over for Starbucks and a bucket of KFC. There it is, right there. Monty Fowler, thanks for busting some serious pencils on some selectively uneducated people.
My pleasure, and I'll endeavor to keep doing it.
Back to answer the very important Alfie Cohn question, what are the schools our children deserve? James Howard Kunstler.
Much smaller schools, decentralized schools, where kids get more attention and more individual attention. You know, we're just going to have to go local, and we got to start thinking about that. I know it's very hard to imagine, but think of it this way. It's probably going to be a lot cheaper. You know, we're not going to be paying $5,000 a year in school taxes or whatever you guys pay over there.
Boom.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Arkansas Rep. Kim Henderson has introduced a bill to ban Howard Zinn's writings from Arkansas schools. No ban here. We honor the legendary activist and historian with our moment of Zinn.
Capitalism has always been a failure for the lower classes. It is now beginning to fail for the middle classes.
iTunes podcast listeners, write us a review, then send us an email of that review to bustedpencils@gmail.com, and we will send you Busted Pencils swag. Thanks to James Howard Kunstler, Monty Fowler, and of course, Matt Damon's mom for joining us on this episode. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to bustedpencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play, and get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk, Busted Pencils Radio.